Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, December 17th, the year of our Lord 2016. What do they officially is called CE now, which is continuing education.
Or current era, or
BCE.
It just depends on what is an era, and why is the current era starting in conjunction with something we used to call BC and AD?
Mm-hmm. Well, at least we
just
don't...
coincidence. Yes. Just pure coincidence.
Pure
there.
Coincidence. The time begins at the supposed birth date of somebody who the rest of the world would just assume
era
ignore.
Started there randomly.
Oh, randomly.
Yes, it's a random thing. It just happens to coincide exactly with that.
With when people used to think he was born. He really wasn't born. He was born 4 years earlier than that.
But that's fine. You know, it's fine. Well,
so
we think.
The clock is off by 4 years. It's well, we're pretty confident at this point. Pretty confident.
But then you have to determine what day, because he certainly was not born January 1st. Was he born?
It was clearly in the spring. We don't know the exact day.
He wasn't born December 25th.
But it was clearly in the spring, and it was 4 years prior to year one.
4 years-ish. Because what part of year one was he 4 years ahead of?
Well,
this is current era. Let's just go back to
pretty confident
era.
Within 60 days or so.
I'm just happy that the calendar is moving forward. It must have been extremely, extremely difficult
to know what
BC
is moving
era,
backwards. BCE.
BCE era, yeah. When the calendar is moving backwards. I would not have been able to keep up with that.
I am a little confused by that myself.
They didn't even have smartphones back there. How are they going to read their calendars?
Yeah, and it's running backwards. And Latin, if you go back far enough, Latin didn't exist, so the word calendar, which is Latin.
And if you think, if the calendars are going backwards at that point, then their clocks had to be going backwards too. How did the clockmakers know at the year one or zero to change the direction of the second hand?
The whole concept of being in the year zero would have been really awkward.
Yes.
And the funny thing is,
it would have been easy to write checks, though.
It's pretty clear that during that time period, people did not know they were in the year zero.
They must just not have had a very good education back then. That's the underlying issue. They just didn't know. They had a lot of ignorant people. They didn't even know what time of day it was.
Well, now I disagree with you there, because they knew it was like the third hour or the second watch, and they knew what time of day it was. They just used different clocks. They used watch clocks.
And that sand didn't even flow uphill in their hourglasses.
Right.
So how do they keep up with the backwards calendar?
That must have been rough, is all I got to say. Actually, setting aside humor for a moment, at any given moment in the Roman Empire during that time period, you had multiple dates.
Yes.
Occurring simultaneously.
And in fact, the reason why we call it the Julian calendar.
Because of Julie.
Is because of Julie. Julius Caesar had a job that he didn't do very well. Throughout his 20s and 30s, he was hanging out. He was the high priest of Juno. And this is a big deal, because he was supposed to be related to the guy. Mm-hmm. And but he spent most of that time hanging out and partying rather than doing his job. And one of his jobs was to update the calendar annually, because they would say, all right, this month is the month of this god or that god, and this is the month of and every year they had a different calendar, and the calendar could go for 420 days or 212, depending on.
Actually, it made sense.
Yeah, you basically do it by who's in charge. So
isn't that the way you run it now?
Sort of, I guess. So then he finally got tired of not doing his job, and he put together a calendar, and then he said, Wait a minute, I don't want to keep doing this. And so he hired the smartest people he could find so that he could be lazy, so that he didn't have to keep updating the calendar.
That's always been my business model.
Right. So he said, let's divide the days properly. Let's throw a leap year in there every 4 years. Let's make this work. He did. He just...
Well, the Julian calendar got pretty bad off.
Right. They did it, but then they took it out, and then they put it back in. See, he set it up with a leap year with a day every 4.5 years instead of 4 years. So they had it off a little bit. So they worked really hard at getting it right. And then he died, and his adopted son added 2 extra months. So if you ever wonder, January is for Janus, And
but when he ran out of gods.
Run out of gods, and March is Mars, and so on. Then you start going by numbers. So October is 8.
Right. It's the 8th month.
But it's the 10th month.
No, and it's the 8th month. It's October.
Oct is 8. And the
and
reason
November
why
November is obviously
11, or is 9.
10. No. Yeah, it's 9.
And Dec, D-E-C, is
that's
10.
Right.
But it's the 12th. And the reason is because his adopted son said, I'm going to add two new gods to the calendar. I'm going to add Julius and Augustus, and we're going to be July and August. So we are gods by vote of the Senate, which
right.
they didn't have a lot of choice because there were legionnaires with drawn swords behind them when they voted in the calendar with
well,
the two new gods,
you know,
which one of them was alive and standing in front of them.
Not very much different today. The United States government used to have its fiscal year end on July 1st.
Right. Now
and
it
in
is
order, in order,
October 31st.
In order to balance the budget one year.
Right. They said, we're going to change the year.
Like it's October 1st.
October
1st,
that's right,
day of the year.
Not 31st.
They moved the fiscal year, and it was in the 1970s. I was in the Army when we did that, and it really messed everything up. But the federal government's year ran 15 months one year so they could balance the budget.
Oh. So,
and they, if we just kept doing that,
things haven't changed that much, is what we're saying.
Politically,
if you want to alter time, you can if you have enough votes.
So the fiscal year now ends. The 2016 fiscal year ended on at the beginning of October, midnight when it turns October 1st. And I think they should slip it 3 more months. That way, you could balance the budget again, and you would have the calendar year and the fiscal year. Ending at the same time, and the United States government would then officially have one fewer years than it existed.
Right. That would be very interesting. Now, the problem with that would be that we would have to then move the date that we're supposed to file taxes.
Oh, no.
Because the IRS has to put together the rules based on the end of the fiscal year and the new tax code coming for the new one.
No. They didn't. When they slipped 3 months on the fiscal year, the tax date stayed the same.
Right. So what you're saying is that the IRS will just have to retroactively tell us whether or not we did our taxes correctly. Yeah, they kind of do that already, don't they?
They already do that. Nothing's changed very much.
Oh, politics.
It all depends on who's in charge, what year it is, in the federal government at least. Now, moving on to something. I noticed a pattern that showed up in the news reports that I read.
You read the news?
I read lots of news reports. And by the way, I strongly recommend that you only believe news that you've paid for. But one of the things that's coming up—
Wait a minute. They're not paying for this program.
Almost daily.
Don't believe us.
Well, that's probably true. only believe that it's probably true. It's like advice. If you think you're not paying for it, you're getting probably a bad deal. The thing that has been popping up, it seems to me like it's almost daily. Now, sometimes I'll go 2 or 3 days without actually seeing it, is some financial advisor getting hammered for stealing lots of money. Now,
yes.
That's a very loose term. They generally are running some kind of Ponzi scheme. Sometimes they just steal the money, and eventually when people ask for the money and it's not there, they realize it never was there to begin with. He was just taking it. But there's a pattern that has been showing up in my observation. I can't honestly say that I've done a survey of all of them because as far as I know, that's not possible to do because most of it they keep it secret until the person is convicted, and sometimes they seal the conviction. But it's called affiliation selling, and some person comes along and says you need to invest and typically this is not uncommon. They go to churches. And they say, I have this special deal for you. The rich people are already doing this, and you ought to do it too. And it's not listed, and it's private investment. It's highly liquid, and it's completely safe. It'll pay you 5-7%
completely,
a year.
There's just two things that just got said there that should tell anybody that's listening that that's a scam. Completely safe and 5-7%. You don't get 5-7% in completely
now,
safe.
Wait a minute. I see annuities advertised for that every day.
Yeah, it's not completely safe.
Okay, so the point is, there are a lot of these going on. I don't know why, except for the fact I think there's a lot of people who think there's some kind of conspiracy out there against the dollar or something. are against their money, or the really big wealthy people have a smarter way of investing than the regular people, which is, by the way, not true. The really wealthy people got that way by doing pretty mundane investing, by and large.
Well, or starting a business and running a business and having that business do really well.
That's mundane investing.
Mundane investing.
Boring, you know. You start a business and you run it for 30 years and you work your tail off and you look around, and if a person decides to sell their business at that point, in many cases, the mere fact that it's existed for 30 years means it's worth millions of dollars. That doesn't mean that the person had some secret insider way of getting the job done. The person was just willing to take the risk of running their own business and ran it in an area where it was financially reasonable to run it at that time and made a lot of money. There are exceptions. There are people who do insider trading. They generally ultimately wind up wearing orange jumpsuits and living in penitentiaries at your expense.
We call those gated communities.
And a lot of folks think that, well, you know, if I can just get into one of these hedge funds, it makes a lot of money. Well, in fact, if you look at the average return of hedge funds that have been started over the last 15 years, you discover they have done much, much, much more poorly. The average return is much lower than that of just if you had invested in a balanced portfolio of stocks and bonds.
But they pay more for that lower return.
Yes.
They pay a lot more for that
lower
return.
Typically in a hedge fund, there's about a 2.5% charge on all the money that's in there, and plus 20% of all the gains.
Yes.
That's so what goes to the manager.
The poor return.
The managers become wealthy.
Yes. See, there you go. People do get wealthy on hedge funds. That's the secret. Just run one.
The guy who raised the price of some critical medication by 1,000% or something a while back. I don't remember the exact numbers on that. But what he had done prior to that is he had run hedge fund after hedge fund after hedge fund. He would set up a hedge fund. It would be in a form of a limited partnership in many cases. He'd set up the hedge fund.
Martin Shkreli, yes.
And he would run a hedge fund. It would collapse in 2 years, then he'd start another one.
And he would pay off the debts of the prior hedge fund with the new money coming in from the new one.
And he was taking 20% of any of his fictitious gains and putting it in his pocket.
See, if Madoff had done his scam the same way, he wouldn't have gone to prison.
Mm. Yeah, he did an old-fashioned Ponzi scheme where there really wasn't anything there at all.
And right. If he had just done it the way Shkreli did it, was just you just start up another hedge fund and you pay off the debts completely legally by doing it.
Yeah, you can do a corporate swap out and it basically.
It's the same thing with a legal mumbo jumbo added on top of it.
So what do you do? And the answer is, I want to be very blunt and tell you some. I'm going to give you some advice here. It's generalized advice. I think it applies to everyone. Unless you're an incredibly sophisticated investor, A, stick with mutual funds under the investment and make sure that they're regulated under the Investment Company Act of 1940. I know you never heard of that, but suffice to say that it's a tremendous act. It does a wonderful job of protecting you against corporate fraud. Number two, demand that whoever advises you to get in a mutual fund or to purchase a mutual fund put in writing that they will be a fiduciary all the time for you, a full-time fiduciary, and will never be adversarial. Put that simply. I will be a fiduciary at all times and will never represent another party in our exchanges. Put their John Henry, put their signature underneath it. And by the way, if you ask somebody who's giving you, quote, a financial advisor to write down, I will be a fiduciary acting in your best interest at all times in every transaction we have and have them sign it, you will find they won't.
They won't sign it.
And there's a really good reason they won't sign it, because they're not acting in your best interest. They're acting in somebody else's best interest, often their own, often the company they work for or the company they're contracted through. And that's okay. It's adversarial. But if they pretend to be an advisor and say, I'm acting in your best interest, just simply look at them and say, put that in writing. I want to see your signature over something that says you are a fiduciary. A fiduciary is a person who acts in utmost good faith in your best interest at all times. If a fiduciary has a conflict of interest, they are required under the anti-fraud statutes to prominently disclose the conflict of interest. Now, in many cases, such as in an ERISA fiduciary, they're not even allowed to have a conflict of interest in the transaction. So if those are the two things that are critical, but they're not. Even that doesn't get you all the way there. Make sure that that mutual fund that you buy produces a statement from wherever you bought it that says you own it. In many cases, that'll be at a brokerage firm, you know, such as Schwab or Pershing or someplace like that, and you'll get a statement that says you own this many shares in this mutual fund. Don't accept it from the person who advised you to buy it, because they can be printing them up on their printer just like anybody else. It's really simple to invest very safely. Now, that doesn't mean the market won't go up and down. That doesn't mean you can't get into bad sectors of the market or something. That's a different issue altogether. But as far as getting your money stolen from you, I strongly recommend people stick with mutual funds, and they stick with using a fiduciary, somebody who will put in writing that they will be a fiduciary at all times, which I'm kind of monopolizing this thing here. It brings me another subject. There've been a lot of sales recently in municipal closed-end funds.
Right.
Tax-free interest. These things are trading at a discount. You can buy into them and get $1.20 worth of mutual bonds for a dollar. Well, a lot of people have discovered that their $1.20 worth of mutual bonds is now worth about less than a dollar, a lot less than a dollar. They're down double digits in the last month or so. Bonds in general are declining and likely to decline in a hurry. We discussed this in our newsletter this week, and we've discussed it again and again. There are some risks that we're facing moving forward. And do you want to talk about that? Or
I would like to add to what you're talking about.
The bottom line to it is we've had a 30-year bull market in bonds. If you held a bond long enough, it would be worth more than you paid for it. 30 years this has gone on, ever since more than 30 now. It actually started about 1980. So it's been 36 years. And one of the problems with that is the people who are offering securities today and who are selling securities today and who are trading securities today, there's very, very few who remember the last bear market in bonds. And a bear market occurs in bonds when interest rates rise. Interest rates have been falling since 1980. Now, they've been very short periods when they bobbed up just a little bit, but people kind of ignored that. And since the financial crisis, there has been a shrinkage in the number of market makers, people who actually buy and sell bonds at the national level.
For good reason.
And the margins have tightened and the regulations have cranked down on them. And there's an awful lot of people whose work I read and when I talk to them just can't imagine a situation where an ultra-safe, guaranteed, insured municipal bond or a bond that's AAA rated or anything of that nature could suddenly collapse in cost and hit a point where you just can't sell them. And that is something I think that it happened with mortgage bonds.
Yeah. And this is something just as an addition here. During the Great Recession, people talked about the fear that all mortgages were not going to get paid. The collapse in the value of the banks that were there weren't a lot of banks trying to buy mortgages from other banks at that point. They just ceased doing it. Nobody knew what was going on.
Right.
The Federal Reserve got involved and bought up a bunch. The reality is that the default rate on mortgages, yes, it got to a record high.
But it was a low record high.
Right. The amount of defaults on the mortgages out there amounted to about 5% of mortgages. So if you think about that across the board, everybody that you know that owns a house, if you know 100 of them, 5 of those people may or may not have been able to be up on their mortgage.
And so you probably wouldn't even encounter that 5 of the people you'd know.
Right. And you're correct. The people that are listening here probably didn't know 5 people that defaulted on their mortgage. The 5%, a lot of that was concentrated in specific areas. And what it did is those specific areas caused people to be afraid enough that they didn't want to buy any mortgage bonds. So even if they're really highly rated, they didn't know that that rating was real, because the really highly rated mortgage bonds on mortgage bonds that were not really that good. So the confusion caused a complete freeze and that type of credit. People were not buying it, not because the underlying mortgages were bad, but because they didn't know if they were bad or good. And when you're talking about interest rates shifting and causing a whole market to change, people are going to sell not based on the underlying quality of the investment, but rather the fact that interest rates cause the value of their investment to go down, so they need to get out, which is the opposite of what people should be doing in that normal situation.
The difficulty with this is, and somebody said, well, and people have often said, well, if I hold it to maturity, it'll be okay. Well, in many cases, it will. You have to be very careful what you're looking at when you say hold it to maturity, because we've actually had municipal failures across the country recently where people didn't get their money back.
There's one taking place right now in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Peace Officers Board Pension Fund. They have issued bonds. Those bonds may or may not be worth anything later. That's part of the issue.
I think eventually the state of Texas will step in on that.
I think so too.
But I
think Dallas is probably going to be able to pay it all. Mm-hmm.
But you've got states like Illinois where they've got a lot of bonds out there, and some of them are high interest bonds that are really questionable. If you had bonds issued by the city of Detroit, in some cases they're not going to get paid off. Certainly there's a lot of money been lost in Puerto Rican bonds. But this is the key issue. It's not that so many municipalities will cease to pay. That may happen. What will happen is, let's just say, and I'm going to use a very hypothetical example. Let's just say you had a 5% municipal bond from some entity somewhere. And a couple of things happen. Number one, interest rates go up across the board, which means people shift their money around. Number two, we have a substantial tax rate decline for higher income people, which is, the last time I looked, was just promised by the guy we elected as president, and the members of Congress seem to be very friendly towards that, and that's not at all unreasonable. Well, all of a sudden, the people who buy municipal bonds, large quantities of municipal bonds, because of the tax-free nature of the income, no longer have anywhere near as much incentive to buy the bonds.
If taxes go down, they don't need to protect the taxes that they're paying as much.
And across the board, interest rates go up. That municipality down the road might be issuing bonds at 10%. These are extreme numbers, relatively speaking, but it's entirely possible it's happened in the past. Well, that means, and this is going to be a very rough number, anyone who really knows the math on this knows it's not necessarily exactly correct, but that means just the economic fair market value of your bond, let's say you put $10,000 in a municipal bond, would drop to about $5,000 if you needed to sell it, or if you died and your heirs wanted to liquidate it. But it might get worse than that, because markets tend to overreact. So the last time we saw interest rates rise, I was in the Army when interest rates started rising, but I can go back and look at the data. And the data says that, for example, longer-term treasuries lost 50% of their value in about 3 years. And the treasury, if you held that treasury bond to maturity, it was going to pay off, and did if you held it for 30 years. The problem was that inflation increased along with interest rates, so that what you got back 30 years later was actually about 30 cents on the dollar as far as buying power was concerned. Now, is that going to happen again? I have no way of knowing, but I suspect it won't be that bad. The issue to be aware of is that there are some risks on the horizon right now, one of which is that the bond market could actually seize up and hit a crisis. You could have insurance companies hitting a crisis at the same time. This would cause the stock market to go into gyrations. Ultimately, it's going to be good for the stock market, but in the short term, it could be really, really scary. So, not that I am sure or even convinced or anything like that these things are going to happen, but they're very distinct possibilities as we go from—
Historically, they have happened,
right.
And this is the right kind of environment. It doesn't mean that it happens every time we get that environment, but it's one of the risks that we look at when— Right now, interest rates are starting up. A lot of people that are investing in bonds don't understand bonds. Bonds historically have been a high net worth investment. People have gotten into bonds with a lot of knowledge of what they're doing. This is kind of like the Senate versus the Congress, the House of Representatives. They're supposed to be more deliberative. But since the Great Recession, a lot more money has flowed into bond positions from people that have never
– I think flown is probably –
Flown, flowed. They flew into bond positions.
Fled.
Flooded.
Fled.
Fled, flooded, flew.
Fled into bond positions.
There's phlegm involved somewhere. They got into these bond positions, and a lot of the people that are in those bond positions don't understand the relationship between bonds and interest rates. They don't understand what makes a bond good quality or bad quality. They may have some experience in the stock market and understanding the quality of a company there. In some ways, bonds are simpler, but in a lot of ways, they are more complex. You mentioned this earlier. The way you buy and sell bonds is not the same way that you buy and sell stocks. If you're buying a stock, you can go to your broker. The broker goes to the big exchange somewhere and buys the stock for you. In some cases, you can go online and act like you are doing the trade yourself. The reality is that online service is your broker. So it buys the stock. When it comes to the bond market, the easiest way to understand this is a simple comparison. And we'll use a really ubiquitous company. We'll say Ford. Ford has a couple of different types of stocks. They've got their preferred stock and they've got a couple of share classes. That's not a whole lot to figure out. You can do some research and figure out what the different stocks amount to. What are your rights with them? What they have thousands of different types of issues of bonds with different maturity dates, different interest rates. Because the way bonds go, it isn't like I'm going to sell my company to you. It's rather, I need some money today, and I need to get a loan today. So I'm going to get a loan. I'm going to issue some bonds. People are going to buy it. Well, next week, Ford may want some other money. So they issue a different kind of bond with a different maturity date and a different interest rate. And there are people that make a market in Ford. There are used to be a lot of people that made markets in Ford. Ford bonds, where they would buy up any issue of Ford, even if they didn't really want it, but they bought it when people were going to sell so that later on if somebody wanted a Ford bond and they could come to that person and buy that Ford bond. It's called making a market. It's very much like the grocery store. The grocery store very rarely is the one with the crops in the field. They're making a market. In the stock market, there are huge exchanges that are set up and they're centralized. In the bond market, there's lots of little exchanges, and there's fewer of those little exchanges than there used to be, which means it's harder to find buyers, which means in this circumstance, if you go to sell and it's a normal environment, you're going to find a buyer most of the time. Sometimes it takes a while. If a lot of people are trying to sell bonds at the same time, first, you may go to your regular bond purchase market maker person and they go, well, I don't have any capacity to buy that from you. So then you got to start hunting around. And when you do that, it starts to cause the investor to panic. Well, we can't find a good buyer for that right now. Well, I'll take less for it. When that happens, it's not happening with just one person. Otherwise, there would be capacity to buy it. Everybody's feeling the same thing. That's the panic. And when that happens, people tend to sell from the stock market too temporarily. Once they look at it and say there's nothing wrong with the stock market, we tend to see the volatility stop there and maybe even get a better situation in the stock market as the money flows out of bonds and into stocks. That's what you should be aware of right now. That is the environment that we're facing. And we haven't faced that for almost 40 years. So keep that in mind.
Another thing we haven't faced in about 40 minutes.
Commercials.
Is doing commercials, so we probably ought to do some.
That's a good idea.
And you're listening to the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes. If you'd like to join us after the break or during the break, and we'll take you after the break, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back. This is the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. It's not hard to remember. It's not hard to punch in on your cell phone. Or if you're dialing that number, would you please tell us when you call in that you dialed the number? Because
with the dial.
Yeah, obviously, we're going through a time warp here, and I wanted to know about that. So at any rate, this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
We got about 20 minutes left this week. So if you have a question and you have been waiting through all of our inane conversation to ask it, now's the time. If you haven't got a question, then you probably shouldn't ask, because then you wouldn't be asking anything.
You know, Jake woke me up to a reality that I had to go back and research.
You were asleep?
I was asleep and didn't know it. I was asleep at the wheel or something.
It's good.
We look at the labor force participation rate, and he was saying that numbers compare it to the 1950s and say our labor force participation rate is low. In fact, it is much higher today than it was in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s.
It's not what the numbers look right, like, because it's looking at a percentage of the people in the labor force. We just have a lot more people as a percentage of our population in the labor force.
The point is that back in the old days when
we had very high labor force participation and now we have very low,
the women weren't counted.
Right.
There's only men in the labor force.
And what's really strange about that is men can't go into labor.
Oh. Well, they can, just a different kind. But actually what's happened when there's a lot of the President's Council of Economic Advisors issued a statement saying wonderful things have happened in the last 8 years. But there also lists some challenges that they are concerned about. And you may hear about those, and the pessimists may want to talk about them. But I looked at them, and none of them are too impressive to me. One of them is the drop in labor force participation. But if you take a look at the data from the Census Bureau, you discover that that drop is simply that there are a lot of women who are choosing not to work in households. And I can tell you precisely why most of them are choosing not to work in that 25 to 54 year old range is because they had babies and they wanted to raise their children. They didn't want to pay for daycare. They didn't want to leave their children to somebody else to raise. And I think that's admirable. I don't think that's something that needs to be corrected. I think it's wonderful. The other thing that they've discovered, a lot of noise about the fall in productivity. Well, whatever it is, it isn't just in the United States.
Well, we've got a big productivity boost. The last report was up 3.1%. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing that as a normal thing.
Right.
We had an abnormal blip.
But what we're seeing, if you look across the board on the G7, those are the developed economic countries in the world, and one end of the scale is Italy, where the labor force productivity is falling. I mean, it's literally less. Since from 2005 to the present, it's actually fallen and is continuing to fall. And in the United Kingdom, it's risen a little bit on average. In France and Germany, goes up. Japan is about the same as Germany. Canada has had a slight rise in their labor force productivity. In the United States, it's risen at 1.3% a year. Now, that's after subtracting inflation out, which admittedly has been very low since then. The point is that it's a worldwide issue. It is absolutely normal following a major industrial revolution onslaught, which is what we saw with the advent of the computer.
Right. We're going to have another one soon with AI and robotics.
Right. We're going to roll into it again soon, and you will see once again,
huge
labor
productivity
force
growth. Yeah.
Productivity growth will go up, and labor force participation will go down. And that's just, there's nothing bad about that.
It's a normal cycle. When new technology hits, whether it's the wheel, whether it's the tractor, whether it's a steam engine, it doesn't matter. When there's a big enough change in technology, productivity goes up because it takes fewer people to do the same amount of work. And that means labor force participation goes down because it takes fewer people to do the same amount of work.
There's a lot of concern, too, about income inequality in that, at least according to the Wall Street Journal, about 20% – this was a little hard for me to stomach, but it's true – about 20% of the income earned in the United States in 2015, which is the last date, of course, we have any records on, was earned by 1% of the people. Again, this is during periods of rapid economic change, rapid technological change. That's not unusual. What you have is a situation where those who have been able to master managing technological change are going to do exceptionally well, and those who have old skills are going to do exceptionally poorly.
There's another piece to this, and it's a big piece of the puzzle. It's just one piece, but it's a big piece. And that is that group of people, that 1% group, the majority of that group isn't there in the following year. They're not the same people year by year. What we're seeing right now, and with part of this income inequality that they're talking about, is that the baby boomers are selling businesses that they have built from scratch their whole lives. They get to a point where they're ready to sell, and I bet most of the people listening to this program know somebody that's done that. So for 1 year, they're in the top 1%. And this is going to continue while the baby boomers retire, because they're going to be hitting that 1% moment. The one time they're in the 1%, their entire lives. By the way, that's the folks that are in the crosshairs by most of the people that want to raise the taxes on the uber wealthy. Mm-hmm. They're treating it like that 1% group is the same people every year. And, you know, the Occupy Wall Street right. folks are saying, we're the 99%. We're against you. Well, most of the 1% is most of the time the 99%. In 1 year or so, it's a 1%. And yeah. we want to be in the 1% at least 1 year. If you don't, then there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. The backside to that, and I think it's very important, and we have had a dearth of telephone calls about this for some reason. I am very optimistic. This is Jeff. I'm speaking for myself. Jake can either echo or object.
Echo.
We are talking about economics here. I am really impressed by some things that are going on in the governmental area, in the congressional and incoming administration area about economics. And I realize that there's going to be some people probably left over from the election who are very upset about this. But I was reading the outlines of a document that Paul Ryan is commonly seen holding, and he will hold it in front of the cameras whenever he gets a chance. It's called A Better Way. It is a new tax code. And man, does that make sense. For example, one of the things that came out in relationship to this is the reason the famous carrier plant that's owned by United Technologies was going to move to Mexico is United Technologies have a tremendous amount of money locked up in Mexico, dollars, that if they brought back to the United States,
they'd have to pay a lot of money on those dollars.
Right. They'd have to pay a quarter of it in taxes, even though the money had not been earned in the United States. And because Mexico has about a 10% tax rate on corporations, we have a 35% tax rate on corporations. So they had this money sitting there doing nothing. And they looked around and said, wow, if we could build a new manufacturing facility down here in Mexico.
We can use the money that's already there to do it.
And it will be productive for us. We'll also get lower labor costs. But the lower labor costs weren't the driving factor. It was the money sitting in Mexico. Now, what Paul Ryan is saying, and I completely agree with him on this, is putting a tariff of 35% on carrier for importing for people who buy air conditioners in the United States will not stop the problem. Matter of fact, it'll make the problem worse. What will happen is you go to buy air conditioners and they will suddenly cost 35% more than they cost last year. What? Because they're almost all of them are now made outside of the United States. So here is a better solution, he said. Why don't we set up a tax code that would no longer force corporations to invest their money overseas and allow them to invest their money back in the United States? For example, if Carrier were to bring the money to build a new plant and do training and facilities and all of that back to the United States, we'd say, okay, we will not charge you income taxes to bring that money back in here. You pay 10% in Mexico, good enough. If you invest that money in the United States within so many years and new plant equipment or whatever, then you don't have to pay any tax to bring it back.
And let me be really clear here. We're not losing tax revenue by doing that.
No, we're gaining.
Because that money's not coming back. So we're not getting the tax revenue that we say that we're due, because it's not due because it's overseas. If we say bring it back and we're not going to charge you on it.
Yeah, some people actually.
Then they'll use it here, and they would much rather use it here.
Some people that I've talked to said, no, I can't. That doesn't make any sense to me. And I said, okay, let's put it like this. Your great uncle, who lives in Costa Rica, which is very friendly to Americans, dies and leaves you $5 million. Now, if you bring that $5 million, this just is a hypothetical situation, of course, it's not really, the tax law really doesn't work that way. If you bring that $5 million back to the United States to live on it, you will have to pay $1.5 million to the IRS. But if you go to Costa Rica,
And you live there.
You'd have to pay money on the, you'd have to pay taxes on any interest you earned or anything like that. But you just go to Costa Rica and live there on the $5 million. Would you bring it back to the United States and pay the $1.25 million to the IRS, or would you move to Costa Rica?
If you're going to pay $1.5 million to live in the United States, just
you'd probably move to Costa Rica, and say, well, yeah, I would. Okay. And
that's the same test that we're applying to corporations. And you have to remember, if you're listening to this program, those corporations are you. You own those corporations, whether it's in mutual funds or in your 401k in mutual funds and stocks and whatever it is. That's your money that we're talking about. And of course, you're going to make that decision to go live in Costa Rica, even if you say, well, I could bring it here. It'd be better for the society if I brought it back. If that may be true, but you don't want to spend $1.5 million to be better for the society.
And the new prime economic advisor to the president who's been hired out, who just nominated, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, I think it's Case. When asked about that, he said, The board of directors at a corporation has a fiduciary duty, and I love the fact that he used fiduciary, to do what is in the best interest of the shareholders. And he says, if building a plant in Mexico, and I'm paraphrasing him here, he said if incorporating outside the United States saves money for the shareholders and it makes their earnings go up, then it's their duty to do that. He said, and you're not going to stop them by putting tariffs and fines on them for doing something like that. We need to restructure the tax code so that we no longer are charging such high taxes to corporations. Now, we may say, yeah, but the corporation should pay instead of me. Well, folks, it doesn't work that way. One of the reasons that jobs have been leaving the United States, Lawrence Kudlow?
Kudlow, something like that.
Is that his name?
Top economics position.
Well, yeah. That's not the guy I was talking about, but I'll have to find the name of the guy I was talking about. But he, and I will look that up in just a second. But the point is that we need to look at our economic setup across the board in the United States, our tax setup, and determine what we're doing that's counterproductive. We've often talked about the fact that if you raise taxes to a certain point, you start to lose revenue. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we're running into is we have raised taxes to the point that we're we are losing revenue to the federal government.
Right. In the corporate area, that we talk about this regularly, that's called the Laffer curve and the Laffer point. When you raise taxes and you lower revenue. If you think of it on a curve that starts at zero and goes to 100%, if your taxes are at 0%, the government makes zero revenue. If your taxes are 100%, the government makes zero revenue because you're going to participate in the black market. You're not going to give up everything that you own to the government. Okay. Somewhere in the middle is a nice spot.
The guy I was talking about is Gary Cohen. And he was nominated this week as the director of the National Economic Council.
Okay.
That will make him one of the most influential voices in economic decisions in the White House. And I read his what he said in the past, his philosophies. He's spoken often at Davos and some other places. And frankly, this guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. He, in a very practical sense, not in the academic or take money from the rich and give money to the poor sense. He simply says that there are things that we're doing that are encouraging corporations to behave in a way that may not be in the national best interest. And but that's not their job. Their job is not to say, okay, let's lose money and send some money to the IRS that we don't need to send because we're really great patriots. Their job is to look at the tax code, get experts to look at the tax code and say, how can we pay the lowest tax, just like you do?
Right. Well, even more so than you do, because you are doing it and you may have, well, as a charitable obligation or as my duty to my country, I will pay all of the taxes that I might possibly be owing without taking any deductions.
Mm-hmm.
The folks at the corporate level have an obligation to their shareholders to use their money in a way that their shareholders want. And the shareholders vote and they say, if you can avoid paying taxes in a legal way, do it, because you shouldn't be forced to pay that money and you shouldn't pay more than we're required to pay. So that's the catch 22.
And one of the problems that he addressed that I really hadn't thought too much about, that I was really in Naples, Florida last month, he was making a speech, Gary Cohen was. And he said, and I'll quote him here, "We have successfully globalized the world, whether we like that or not, which means we have successfully globalized monetary policy." But what does that mean? It means now we have a global growth issue and we're trying to solve it with domestic policy. It's not going to work. The Fed used to be able to control the U.S. domestic economy because we had a domestic economy. Now the United States economy is part of a global economy. We have a globalized workforce. So when I need to go out and hire the incremental worker, I look around the world and see where that incremental worker is available. And we have to recognize that reality. I'm frankly glad that there are people coming into positions of influence who recognize that the world has changed and it's bigger than the United States, which is in many ways contrary to what to the platform that President-elect Trump ran on. But we really do have to recognize we cannot isolate ourselves from a global world, so we need to adapt to it in such a way that it's in our best interest. The problem is not that the world has gone globalized. The problem is that the world has gone globalized largely with our leadership, while we attempted to maintain policies in the United States that were counter to the very things we were leading in the world.
Right. And that's really when Trump talks about the bad deals on NAFTA. That's a big part of it. If we have free trade with Mexico, if we have free trade with Canada, if we have free trade with a big chunk of the world, and we're able to import those goods from overseas or from across a border without any difficulty, because there's no tariff on that good. But that means that if we manufactured those goods in Mexico and we sell them in America, or and that money goes to Mexico, to get that money into America, we don't have free trade on monetary exchange. There's a tax that comes with that. That's not true free trade. And what that does is it leaves a lot of money, American money, owned by Americans in foreign countries where we're going, what do we do with it? We got to do something with it. And we certainly don't want to pay a huge amount of money on taxes just to bring it home. We can do something with it in Mexico. We can do something with it in Costa Rica.
And we mentioned this before, and you didn't hear it, it's worth – then you need to hear it now. And if you have heard it before, it's worth hearing again. The Carrier plant in Indianapolis is a prime example of what's actually going on. The Carrier has said, we're going to keep the jobs here, but it doesn't say how long. It's going to get $7 million a year in tax credits. And in that, with that $7 million a year, it's going to automate that plant. So the jobs will disappear. Now, they may not move overseas.
They're still opening a plant in Mexico.
Right.
They're just not opening the plant and closing the one there. They're
right.
Just downsizing that plant tremendously.
And they're going and basically,
they're
going
to downsize it with automation to the point where it's not really the same thing anymore anyway.
And that's where we get the productivity growth. So the issue is education and a recognition that we need to do what we can to offset that, but it's going to happen, and you can't reverse it. So,
about out of time.
It is come to the end of the time. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, which also happens to be an investment advisor. We work with generally people with higher net worth, and we use wealth management techniques to assist them in a whole lot of areas. You can reach us off the air where we have a recording on weekends and live people answering the telephone during the week locally at 254-947-1111, or
you can reach that same line toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. It has our philosophy. Some of our newsletters are up there. And if you didn't get enough, more of the radio.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.